G'day from the Neurophysio Podcast, the show that brings you clinically relevant professional development and explores career pathways and options for allied health clinicians. On the show over the past 2.5 years, we've been really proud to go deep with our guests about some challenging areas of clinical work and sometimes the injustices that we notice. Today's episode hits one of those areas that we've debated before, people living with disability, specifically young people. In a moment, we'll be chatting to a physiotherapy researcher who aims to improve the health and well-being of people with disability. But as usual, let's reflect on last month's episode with renowned Professor Leanne Carey. Erin, your thoughts?
Yeah, it was such a good episode. What Leanne has done for sensation, for stroke survivors and other people with neurodisability has just been incredible. And I think the way she's trying to get that knowledge out there with educating clinicians first in the workshops, but then expanding that to knowledge translation with the Sense Implement part of her projects. And then now these specialist centres where people out in the community, even if they're not connected into rehab centres, can actually refer in and even self-refer in if they've got sensory deficits via that Sense Connect program. I just think it's so cool. It's so far reaching. And the next steps, I think, for them, the Sense Therapy group, are to go more international. I know they're running workshops overseas, but it's sort of maybe more in Southeast Asia. And I think she said the Middle East. So I think it needs to go broader, maybe online, maybe training up people internationally. I don't know, maybe some of our listeners might be interested in trying to find out how that can be started up because, yeah, word needs to get out more, I think. What do you reckon?
I love the, it's probably not the right word, but linearity of the whole thing of, you know, we can see where it's really come from and see where it's going. That's, Sense work. So it won't be as surprising for you or for anyone else who's sort of caught on to the fact that I'm a huge science nerd. And I love that aspect of the thing of looking back at where, Sense has come from and really come from a really firm foundation in neuroscience and going back and talking to the original neuroplasticity people, in the development of the whole program. I was super impressed by that. That's something that I love to hear about.
I think one of the things that's really cool about the Sense approach is it gives clinicians like these really core skills. Like they attend a workshop and they've got these really core skills that they can apply in practice and make a difference straight away. It's not kind of too ambiguous that, they're not sure how to translate it. Like it actually gives them tools straight away. But then it's not some sort of recipe or some sort of kind of cultish approach. Like it's actually based in evidence and research and science, as you say, and you're teaching the client to actually learn how to learn more about sensation so that they can carry on those skills to better themselves even beyond the clinical sessions as well. I think that's why it's quite powerful technique.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more.
Cool. Well, episode today is with Dr. Nora Shields, and she's a professor of physiotherapy at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. She started her career in Ireland with her physiotherapy degree and PhD both completed at the prestigious Trinity College in Dublin. She also holds a graduate certificate in higher education.
Yeah, Nora developed a program called Fit Skills about 8 years ago, and now it's gone from strength to strength as her and her team continually research the program and its benefits and build it from one study to the next. Fit Skills is an innovative program which facilitates young people with disability to exercise with a physiotherapy student mentor, addressing one of the major barriers to physical activity for this group, the lack of social support. So Nora tells us about the program, the strong evidence and theory base behind it, and how it's making such a huge difference to the lives of young people with disability as well as physio students.
We also discuss societal and systemic issues hindering young people with disability from achieving their full potential, the general skills you gain out of a PhD, and of course, we explore Nora's career pathway. We're excited to be jumping back into the disability space and trying in some way to highlight the barriers faced by people living with disability. So we hope you get inspired by the discussion in this episode.
This episode was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. We pay our respect to the Wurundjeri as the traditional custodians, recognising their continued connection to land, waters and culture of this area and acknowledge that they never ceded sovereignty. We also pay our respects to elders past, present and future.
And just a reminder, the people we interview on this podcast are representing their own views, thoughts and opinions as individuals, which are not necessarily the views of their employers, organisations or committees that they're associated with. Equally, the advice and information shared on the podcast is general only and should not be taken as medical advice.
Welcome to a Neurophysio podcast. I'm Erin Bicknell.
And I'm Matt Wingfield. And today we've got a little bit of an origin story of mine with our guest on the podcast. So back when I was in, I reckon it was second year uni, I participated in a research project that was run by Professor Shields, who we're about to speak to. And it was my very first foray into the research world. And here I am now doing a PhD. So, you know, if anything, Nora, you're to blame for that. But anyway, welcome to the show, Professor Nora Shields.
Oh, thanks for having me, Matt and Erin. Lovely to be here.
Excellent. So one of the things that, you know, we always do is we talk about your origin story a little bit. So one of the topics we're going to talk about is, you know, how instrumental you've been in the research world with youth disability. So can you talk about your career path to this point and how that particular area sucked you in?
Yes, exercise has always interested me. I was very active growing up, but really my research interests began when I moved to Australia, and I was asked by a colleague to help out with the systematic review that they were doing on Down syndrome. And I hadn't done a systematic review at that stage. I've done about 50 now, but I hadn't done one. And so I really wanted to learn how to do it. And when we were doing the review, I realized very quickly this was a pretty well-defined group of people for whom there was a very, very, very small amount of evidence. And I remember describing this to somebody else a couple of years ago about, and this might not necessarily work in an Australian context, but, you know, the first fall of snow during winter when, you know, the fields, you just get this beautiful blanket of snow and it just looks pristine and untouched and all the rest of it. All you want to do as a kid is run out and put your footprints all over it, all the rest of it. That's kind of, from a researcher's perspective, when you find this, you know, area of research where there is so little evidence, what you want to do is you want to be that first person to go out there and do something new and novel and innovative and kind of be, you know, put your footprints on that area. So it's really like being the first person to walk on in the, you know, in the snow. So that's the kind of hook that hooked me in, if you like, that this was an area that just seemed to have been largely left untouched within physiotherapy. And then the thing is once you start working and once you start meeting this group of young people and their families, that's the bit that gets you sucked in. That's the, you know, kind of you just meet all these wonderful people who give so generously of their time to the work that you do. And then you as a researcher can make a positive and a very real and a big impact on their lives in a relatively short space of time. And so, you know, I get a lot of satisfaction out of seeing that immediate and useful benefit for young people with disabilities and their families. So that's what got me sucked in, and that's what keeps me going back for the next study and the next study and the next study.
Nora, did you work in that space with people with disability, young people with disability in islands?
No, I didn't actually work for very long in this area before I moved to Australia. In fact, I had only just recently got a position in one of the large pediatric hospitals in Dublin just before I moved to Australia, and I actually left that position in order to take up the role here in Melbourne. But even that short period of time that I've been working in pediatrics, I really got a taste for an area which I never really thought I would love and enjoy and get as much satisfaction out of as I did. So I think the seed had been planted when I was in Ireland, but then it was just that when I got this opportunity in Australia, I I thought, well, actually, yeah, why not?
Yep. So that opportunity, was that to come and work at La Trobe University?
That's right, yeah.
So you actually hadn't worked in the academia space in Ireland and then came here to do it. Like, what was that experience like? A whole new country and then, you know, a whole career change, it sounds like, as well.
A little bit in that I had completed my PhD just before I moved, and I had done that full time. And that was quite unusual in Ireland at the time because, you know, there were a very small number of physios with PhDs around the time that I graduated. And I think I was the very first full-time PhD student at Trinity College Dublin. There had been others who had done their PhDs, but most of them had worked, continued to work clinically and study part-time. Yeah, so again, I was a little bit ahead of the curve in that sense, I left a clinical job to go back and study full-time. But while I was studying, as many PhD students out there will attest to, you continue to work clinically in a part-time capacity, and I was also teaching, so I'd actually amassed sort of 3 years of teaching across two universities and two different subject areas, so I graduated, I suppose, with a PhD, but also with this, you know, kind of a fair amount of teaching experience. But yeah, the position at La Trobe was my first academic position. So yes, I was coming to a new country and a new job, and yes, that was equally terrifying and thrilling in equal parts.
Was your PhD at Trinity done in physioactivity?
No. It was actually done in electrotherapy, would you believe it or not? So it came about because when I was, I think, in my final year in physio, I went to just the routine in services that every physio department will run, and the in service that day was run by a medical physicist, Dr. Neil O'Hare, who ended up becoming one of my PhD supervisors, and he was talking about his role in the medical physics department at the hospital and how he was responsible for the area of physiotherapy. And I always had a real love of all things sort of physics and maths and that sort of real science background. And so I stayed on after the in-service and I was chatting to him, and you know, he was talking about different opportunities that he saw within the physiotherapy area. So I'd had this initial conversation as a fourth year student, and then, you know, went off about business and graduated and, you know, was working clinically. And essentially, you know, once in the hospital, the phone rang in the department and I answered it. And it was one of my old lecturers who went on to be my supervisor. And he said, yeah, I've been talking to Neil O'Hare and we're going to propose this PhD project. Do you want to do it? It was one of those days in the clinic, and I just said, yeah, sign me up.
Got you at a weak spot.
That was it. Caught me right at that, right at the right time kind of thing. So I ended up, catching up with the head of the physio discipline at that time, who was Peter Young, who sadly has died since. And Peter and I went to the pub, and over a pint of Guinness, we talked about me doing a PhD.
Be more Irish.
That's it. And yeah, and so then they offered me an Usher Fellowship, which is sort of quite a prestigious fellowship within the university. There's only seven across the whole university awarded per year. And so they offered me one of these fellowships. And so the rest, they say, is history. I went back and, did my PhD. And I took a really, there are different ways of looking at PhDs, the reasons why people do PhDs. I've always been quite pragmatic about it. I know lots of people very much focus on the content of the PhD. For me, it was actually much more about learning the skills, and particularly learning how to write. And so when I finished, I was very much ready to kind of move on from that area and find a new area. So I was sort of primed in that respect, that it was it was quite a pragmatic decision to do my PhD in that area.
So Nora, does that mean that you did have that sort of research spark quite early on? Like it sounds like maybe a little bit in fourth year and when you were working clinically as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And but it sort of wasn't immediately obvious. Like many physio grads, I thought I wanted to be a sports physio. I thought that was what I really want to do. And so when I had finished, there was a really quite prestigious sports medicine master's. You know, I thought, yeah, that's where I want to go with this. So I applied and I got accepted to do it. And then the invoice came in to pay for the course, which at the time was about £6,000 at the time, which was a lot of money. And so I went, do I really want to do this? And the answer was, no, I don't think so. I don't think I want to do it that much. So I decided to go and get a job and earn some money rather than pay some more money.
Can I just pick up quickly? One of the things that I love that you said earlier was about the methods of learning how to, you know, research when you're doing your PhD. Like that's what it's about for you. See, for me, like I love my content topic that I do. One of the things that I'm most excited by is the thinking, the depth of thinking, that the skills to be able to analyze and think at a completely different level to what I was before starting a PhD. So I think that's a really undersold part of the process, I think, is the other skills that really, you know, filter out into everything else. So I thank you for picking that up. Have you got any other thoughts on other things that you think are really important in the PhD sort of process?
Oh gosh, now that's a really good question, Matt. I think the other things, like for me, it's really about the writing. I think learning how to write and learning how to write well is a sort of an undersold skill, and it really is a skill, and really the only way of learning how to write like well is to practice it. And I very much took that to heart in my PhD. Was, you know, I actually ended up, I published about 10 papers out of my PhD, and you know, that was really just about learning how to write rather than having a lot to say per se. But I think, you know, some people naturally write beautifully, and when I get those students, I really love them. Supervising them, because you can actually get into the content in a much deeper way very quickly when you know they can write about it quickly. But I spend quite a lot of my time really focusing on the skill of writing, and maybe sometimes I focus on it a bit too much. I have a tendency to over edit my students' work, and they will tell you that. Cups are a good place, you know.
And is this skill in writing, is it about how to fit all of the components that you need to sell and you need to have in a publication, I guess, into a word count? Or is it also in the kind of the prose and the language and the, you know, the beauty of how it's written as well, not just the kind of mechanics?
It's both. It is about structuring things well so that there is a flow or a style or, you know, an ease to the writing. But it is also about doing that within 3,000 words of a paper, which, you know, can be really tricky when you're writing to sort of say, well, which bits am I going to cut out? Because I spent about 3 hours writing that one sentence, and you know, I really want to keep that sentence in, but actually it's not adding to the whole lot and I need to delete it.
That's so true. Yeah.
One of my PhD supervisors, her term is hand waving, and I get so many things back from her going, stop hand waving. It's an extra sentence trying to emphasize my point again. She's like, you're hand waving, we know that already, move on.
That's lovely. I might use that one in future.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Credit
I will do.
So let's come back a step and go back into some of the media sort of stuff that we want to talk about with your research. So, you know, physical activity, it's something that, you know, we continue to pour billions and billions of dollars into. And then at the end of the day, it turns out that the best thing anyone can ever do for themselves is exercise. So can you tell us, in the context of your work, you know,
why is it so good for, I mean, why is it so good for everyone, but why is it particularly good for, you know, the youth disability population or the neurological population?
Welcome to Fuller Butts, a behind-the-scenes plastic surgery podcast. Yes, you heard that right. Join your co-hosts, Dr. Sam Fuller and Dr. Dan Butts, board-certified plastic and reconstructive surgeons, on an exclusive full-access pass into the world of plastic surgery. Combining their expertise and training, Drs. Fuller and Butts will share medical insights, detailed explanations, and lighthearted humor to keep you entertained and informed. We're certain you'll become passionate about the plastic surgery specialty, and between debunking myths, uncovering truths, or just making you laugh out loud at their perspective on this creative and artistic field, we've got something for everyone.
I think for me, it's because it impacts every single cell in the body, and the benefits are just to every system in the body. And it's just a really good way of investing your time. I remember giving a talk once, you know, trying to think about, well, you know, kind of how can I really convince people that this is a, you know, a good way to invest your time? Because often when we're working with people, the first thing is, I don't have time. You know, I don't have time. Well, actually, we've all got the same amount of time. It's just how are you prioritizing your time? And so, you know, I sort of used it more about, you know, sort of an investment thing. Well, you know, you get really good bang for your buck if you invest some of your time in physical activity. In fact, it can add years to your life. Even just being physically active for 15 minutes a day adds about 3 or 4 years to your life. So it's, you know, pretty good return on investment. But I think for young people with disability, one of the things that we've really come to understand or to know is that physical activity isn't a luxury for many of them. You know, for the rest of us, it's almost, you know, we have a choice. We can choose to invest our time being physically active, or we can choose not to. But actually, for many young people with disability, it's not a choice. They really do need to keep physically active, because if they don't, the consequences can be really dire. So, you know, for example, we know with young people with CP that as they get older, their functional, their physical functional capacity can decline quite rapidly. And so staying physically active and you know, participating in exercise is their way of actually keeping their bodies, you know, maintaining the physical conditioning of their bodies so that they can continue to live their lives.
Yeah, that's a really good point that you make, of that it is an essential thing for so many, for these people to do. One of my heroes growing up was Kurt Fernley, and still is one of my heroes, who's a wheelchair marathon athlete who's just an absolute beast of a human being. But you've heard him and now people like Dylan Olcott and that sort of profile of saying, you know, it's when you can't be what you can't see, sort of thing. So, you know, having people in these high profile positions to be able to actually, you know, show young people that this is the way to go, there is exercise available to them, and those sorts of, you know, even competitive sport, for example. But, you know, I think that's just such an important thing of the youth people with disability being able to actually visualize that part of it. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, the influence that society has on that participation.
Yeah, I think society has a huge influence on participation in physical activity, and particularly for people with disability. And we recently completed a really lovely mixed methods systematic review, led by one of my PhD students, Georgia McKenzie. It was published last year in Developmental Medicine and Child Neurology. And what Georgia did was she looked at all of the literature that had been published that had investigated barriers and facilitators to physical activity for people with physical disabilities aged 15 and over. And the bottom line is that environmental barriers are the main thing that influence participation in physical activity for this group. And that's really important finding, because if we think about our health service, it's kind of set up and predicated on the individual, you know, that individual responsibility, that it is your responsibility to be active. What that fails to recognize are the systemic barriers that mean people cannot participate in physical activity, either in the way they want to or as often as they want to. And the social environment is part of that. You know, when we think of environment again, we often go straight to the physical environment, you know, and accessibility of buildings and all of that. And I have to say, still in 2022, we're still talking about physical accessibility of environments. But the other part of the environment that's really important is the social environment. And, you know, young people with disability, they've told us that, you know, the social connectedness, so feeling like they belong in a place and social support are really key facilitators of physical activity. So, you know, if you don't have the social support that you need to be physically active, it's much harder to be physically active. And if you don't feel like you belong in a place, well, then you're probably not going to really want to go there and try it out. So in the Fit Skills study that we recently completed, we interviewed like over 90 young people with all different types of disabilities. And when we started reading these interviews, one of the first things that really struck us was just how many of the young people talked about before their experience in Fit Skills that they were, you know, they felt anxious or they felt nervous about going into a community gym setting. You know, that they felt they were afraid that they wouldn't belong there. They were afraid that people, you know, they'd stick out like a sore thumb or that, you know, people would stare at them. They were afraid of doing the wrong thing. So they were afraid that they either mightn't know how to use the equipment or that they might injure themselves by doing something wrong. And that really struck me because yes, I had thought that people might be a little bit hesitant about going in, but I hadn't really understood or really appreciated the depth of that concern or how they felt. And when you think about it, if you know, you can understand why their perceptions might be that way. So if we think about gyms and the advertising around going to the gym, you know, what do the pictures look like? Well, the pictures look like young people who are pretty lean or pretty buff and they're wearing the sort of the right clothes and they look a certain way and all the rest of it. And young people with disability just don't see themselves represented in lots of that advertising. And and so when you think about it that way, yes, you can think why they might have such apprehension about going into the gym in the first place. So I think I absolutely agree with Kurt and Dylan and everybody else. You can't become what you can't see.
Yeah, I think it's a really powerful message, and it sounds like your research is showcasing what this experience is like for young people with disability. But also it sounds like you're doing some work to try to remedy this issue out there in the world. So can you tell us more about what Fit Skills is?
Essentially, the bottom line with Fit Skills is that you have a young person with disability and you match them with a student mentor from roughly the same locality, and they go to their local gym and they exercise together twice a week for 12 weeks. And the reason that it's sort of set up in that way is when we spoke to young people with disability, they said one of the main reasons that they don't exercise, as said, was because they lacked the social support to do that. They needed somebody to exercise with. When I was reading graduate student surveys responses, so, you know, one of the things that all physiotherapy courses do as part of their accreditation is that a year after the graduates have gone into the workforce, they get surveyed to say, well, what did you think of the course? What was good about it? What would you change? All of those kind of things. So when I took over coordinating the pediatric curriculum, I was reading lots of these sort of surveys from, you know, sort of the previous two or three years. And the thing that struck me is that the number of students who were saying, well, we would like to have more experience working with young people. And so here I was on the one hand with a group who needed somebody to exercise with, needed a person to help them exercise, and a second group who wanted more experience working with young people. So essentially FitSkills kind of puts those two groups together. And that's really important because it's a win-win. So each person in that partnership gets something out of it. So the young person with disability gets the social support that they need to exercise, and the student mentor gets the opportunity to get to know a young person with disability. And we know from the data that we have that actually one of the things that really happens with the student mentors is that they get this really rich understanding of disability, and that their attitudes to disability change in a positive way. And also they become much more comfortable interacting with young people with disability. So there's really some quite powerful things going on.
How far back does that idea go of that pairing your student with someone who's a young person with disability? And the reason I ask is going to become obvious in a second, because that's where I recognize your fingerprints all over the FitSkills project. Is that's what I was for in your project with a young gentleman with Down syndrome. So like, how far back does that go, and like, where did that idea come from?
Yeah, so the idea really so first of all, Matt, actually it was We were really lucky to have you as one of our student mentors, and if it's okay, I'll take the opportunity to say thank you to all of the student mentors we've had working with us over the last 15 years, because the students, they all volunteer their time to take part in the project and really are kind of espouse the spirit of FitSkills. So really, without our student mentors, we wouldn't have a program. So I just wanted to take the time to say that while I had the opportunity. How far does it go back? Well, it kind of goes back to about sort of 2006. And I was working with an honours student, and I proposed an honours project that was about just understanding why young adults with Down syndrome weren't physically active. And it was a first qualitative study that I'd done, and we learned so much from this first study that it's sort of, I still go back to it because it's really seeded a lot of the work that I did. But essentially, that was the first time that we really heard young adults and their families say, we need somebody to exercise with. And as I say, at the same time, working with the students and hearing them say, we need more experience working with young people. And so the very first time that I sort of decided, well, what would happen if I put a physio student in a gym with a young person, And I think at that point, we recruit really smart, fabulous people into our profession. Our physio students are really, really bright young things. And so the very first study we did, I managed to get this really small grant to test out the idea. Well, what would happen if you put a physio student and a young person with disability into the gym together? Would it all go okay? And I laugh now because I had tried to get an internal grant at the university twice to test this idea out, and I've been rejected both times. And so I said, no, it's a good idea, So I sort of forged ahead, and I managed to get an external grant, and that was the first external grant that I got of my own. And it was for, I think it was $7,700 was the amount. So really small grant. But with it, we ran this small randomized controlled trial. We found that yes, A, it does work, but B, there was an indication that it was actually effective for the young person with Down syndrome as well. There was this flicker of yes, their muscle strength seems to be going in the right direction, and so that was kind of where it started out. And basically from that pilot work, we used that to seed the first NHNMRC project grant that we got. So again, you know, didn't get it the first time round, got knocked back, but managed to get it up. And so again, it was kind of, well, I went from that $7,700 to getting, I don't know, it was about $175,000, which, you know, again, in those terms is a relatively small amount of money. And I think that was part of the study that you were part of, Matt. So we then tested the idea on 68 young people with Down syndrome. And it was really after that that trial that the participants in the experimental group, we just kept getting this overwhelming feedback of that really worked. That this model, it works for us. We've really enjoyed doing it. We'd like to do it again. Can we do it again? You know. And so the trial coordinator, you know, kept hearing all these studies. She just said, "No, you got to do something about this. You can't just leave this. This is overwhelming, and it's very consistent." And so we did. So we decided to see if we could get some funding to sort of test the idea. Could you translate this into a sort of an ongoing fee for service community program? And so we did. We got a small philanthropic grant to establish the program, and Kirsty Bullard Smith came on board at that point as the Fit Skills program coordinator, and kind of over the next sort of 7 years we ran this really kind of boutique program with an annual intake of somewhere around 20 young people a year, with matching with a student mentor. And you know, it initially started that people would pay for the service, and then we supplemented that with some philanthropic money that we had. And during that time, of course, the other thing that happened was that there was the rollout of the NDIS, and so people started to say, well, can we use our NDIS funding to pay for the program? And then, so we continued to collect data while we were doing this. And again, we used those data then to you know, kind of seed an NHNMRC partnership grant, and brought on board our community partners with that. And so that partnership project, literally, we just managed to kind of get it finished by the skin of our teeth in March 2020, just as the pandemic was hitting. So we've kind of, you know, built it up over time. But I think, just to go back to your original question about, you know, sort of where did the idea come from, you know, the practical, I've told you about the practical sort of side of the ideas, but in fact there is a really strong theoretical rationale for why it works. And it was only kind of in hindsight that, you know, kind of realized this, but that's contact theory. And really what contact theory tells us is that if you put people together where they're working towards the same goal, and you take out the element of competition, you actually create a scenario where people really actually kind of get to know each other and get to understand everybody else's perspective. So one of the key things about that is that the student mentor isn't there as a health professional. They're not there as a fitness trainer. They are there as an exercise partner. They're there they're purely to provide the social support, and you know, that's part of the reason why it works. So we do ask the student mentors to exercise as well, because, you know, they're not there for any other reason than to help. And so it kind of makes sense that they exercise as well while they're at the gym. So lots of reasons for the students to be involved.
I was going to ask, do the students exercise as well? So that answers that question. How important do you think this work is for physio students? Because I'm just thinking, you know, you can have a lot of physios that go into working with adults, into perhaps the hospital system, or maybe into private practice, you know, orthopedics, musculoskeletal, or indeed sports, and maybe not come across people with disabilities that often in their careers. So having that exposure and working with people with disabilities right at the start of their careers, that could profoundly change the way they view this throughout the rest of their career, couldn't it?
Absolutely. It's like it's really important. I think, again, I had sort of a moment early on in the piece that really colored my view of this in a very positive way. And that was, I've always worked very closely with the community disability organizations in the field. And so one of the very first community organizations I got to know really well was Down Syndrome Victoria. And the CEO at the time was Kathy McAlpine, who's still a big player in the disability field. But I remember talking to Kathy about, the sort of initial results that we got and about, the young people with Down syndrome, they got so much stronger. And I said, yeah. And the students seemed to really kind of understand disability more. And she picked up on that really, really, really quickly. And she made it very clear to me that actually that was the finding that they as an organization were much more impressed by than, kind of a change in muscle strength. It was the fact that you could change societal attitudes to disability by getting people to spend time. And that was particularly important in people who are our future health workforce, because, we have this assumption, I think, that people who go into physiotherapy automatically have positive attitudes to people with disability, probably because physios work so often with people with disability. But actually, the data don't bear that out. So when students come into physiotherapy, their attitudes to disability really reflect societal attitudes to disability. And as we know, society by and large views disability as a tragedy. And so I think one of the key things about the work has been that getting to know a young person with disability really challenges that sort of notion, because I think if you've never had the experience of disability or you don't know somebody with a disability, your ideas about disability are probably very formed by what you pick up in the media and what you pick up from society in general. So if you've got this prevailing negative attitude about disability, or if when you're, turning on your media feeds and all you're hearing about is how much the NDIS costs and how the costs have blown out and all the rest of it, and if the corollary is not, or the counter argument is not there that actually, the NDIS has been life-changing to many people with disabilities. So, you could be forgiven for thinking that it's a burden rather than just part of everyday life for people. And so, and again, one of the really kind of points where this really hit home was in the interviews that we've done with student mentors, where we've got them to talk about their experiences and sort of what they thought about and what they liked. And it was really interesting because, again, very early on, we started seeing this really consistent narrative that the students told us, it kind of, I remember the quote from one student that went something like, I sort of realized that they were just like me, that they had the same hopes and dreams and wants and wishes that I do. And I remember telling a young person with disability this, this is what the students say. And the young person will go, well, duh.
Yeah.
So it is a bit of a light bulb moment for many students because they haven't had that experience, and they get to have that experience and they suddenly it's a bit of a myth busting experience for them and really challenges their assumptions. So it's really important for physiotherapists that we have, and even actually across health, that we have a workforce that has an understanding of what it means to live with a disability and has has the opportunity to get to know somebody with a disability. And we've got some really exciting data from the FitSkills trial, which we've analyzed it. It's not peer reviewed yet, but it really shows us that the experience isn't just among physio students. It's also among OT students and exercise science students, and it doesn't seem to matter what type of disability the young person has. In fact, if anything, students that are matched with somebody with more complex disabilities have a sort of a stronger positive reaction to fit skills. And ditto with people who have had some experience. I mean, if you've had no experience with people with disability, your level of comfort interacting with people with disability, there's a much bigger change in that. So I think it's really important that we do in our workforce training really think about this and take it seriously, because, you know, 1 in 5 people in Australia has a disability.
There's numbers are huge, and one of the things that, you know, I had to check myself on last year when we were getting a lot of CP, adults with CP coming through, young adults with CP coming through our hospital here, was like, I flopped into a routine of not asking about employment. And I don't know why, right? But every single one of them would come through and be like, you know, it's, well, what do you guys? Oh, I want to be able to do my job better. And I think that's where you talk about the NDIS and the ability for them to access rehabilitation and maintenance to be able to continue to contribute to society like you and I. I don't know why that missed my mind, and I'm quite embarrassed about that, to be honest.
The other part of that, that about doing your job, because again, we sort of think about the physically being able to do your job, but the other thing that again, I don't think we've really given the same priority to is just the cognitive fatigue that many young people with disability experience. Being physically fit and healthy and maintaining your health is actually also part of being able to counter that cognitive fatigue. Absolutely. I mean, the employment figures for young people with disability are still abysmally low, and I think we've certainly come a long way. But you know, we've got so much work to do in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you alluded to some of the data earlier, and obviously, you can't. It's going to be embargoed until it's peer reviewed and the rest of it. So, rather than telling us what your outcomes are, what were you hoping your outcomes would be before you went and did the project from the fit skills, I should say?
Oh, I was hoping it would work. and it does mostly. I mean, you know, we have published some of the data. So, you know, the first sort of thing was, is it feasible? So we knew that it was possible on the small scale, but really what we wanted to know was, can you scale it up? Because that's one of the things we see across research interventions. They always work with small groups of people, but the minute you try to scale them, it's more difficult. So we have published that piece of work, and essentially it's kind of, well, yes, you can scale it up, but there are some caveats around communication and scheduling. So you know, it's not perfect, but yes, you can scale it up. I think the other thing that we were hoping was is that, you know, it would be of benefit to the young people with disability. And we're still analysing the sort of the more objective outcomes from that. But, you know, we have published just again recently a qualitative analysis of interviews with just under 40 young adults with CP about, you know, how they felt sort of before they did fit skills and then sort of what their experiences were. And what really came through from that was that the social context of fit skills was really critical. And that in terms of the outcomes that were most important to the young people, there were psychosocial outcomes. So it was the mental health benefits and the benefits on sort of how you feel and what your mood are and those kind of things that really came through, which again sort of challenges the sort of, you know, the old ideas of, well, it's just about physical health. I mean, really the message from young people with disability is actually things we really value is what it does for our mental health and for our mood. The other thing that they told us, which again kind of makes sense, but perhaps which we hadn't really appreciated, was just the organizational and the logistic support that is needed in order to facilitate their participation. So actually, one of the reasons they liked Fit Skills was because it took away a lot of that burden from them. So they didn't have to go and find a gym. The gym was found for them. They didn't have to go and find the support person. That person was found for them. They had trust in the people prescribing the exercise, that they had trust that they would be safe, and that they, you know, that was again another reason. So while, you know, we haven't sort of, can't tell you definitively if it's effective or cost effective, there's sort of early signs that what young people got out of it was important to them, and that those health benefits, you know, mental health and mood benefits, actually poured over into other aspects of their life. So it wasn't just in the immediate gym context, but it sort of went on to influence how they work, as you've alluded to, Matt. And the other thing that I think was really important outcome that we found was we wanted to get an idea about the demand for the program, because we wanted to know, well, you know, for any service, you've got to know sort of what the demand is going to be like. And so we collected some data, you know, on people who expressed interest in Fit Skills, but also from our partner organizations about their membership numbers and sort of the percentage of people who within their memberships were interested in the program. And the population demand for it was about 9%, which at first call kind of seems quite low. You'd say, oh, that's, you know, that's not particularly impressive. But if you think about at population levels what public health organizations are trying to achieve, most national and international targets really talk about increasing the number of people physically active of levels of around 4 and 5%. And so here we are with 9% of this population interested in participating. So that what that tells me, or the way I've interpreted that is actually young people with disability are very interested in participating in physical activity. And so we need programs like this to provide them with the choice and the opportunities that they need to participate.
And given all of that, Nora, does that mean that the program is continuing post-COVID?
COVID really stopped us in our tracks, because of course gyms were one of the first places to shut down, and they're one of the last places to open up. And of course the other part of the pandemic is that we know people with disability have been disproportionately affected. So we haven't started up just yet, because you know, we're all still sort of living out this pandemic and seeing how it's going to go. But one of the things that has happened since is that we've used the data that we have from Fit Skills in order to get funding for a new project, which is called Gym Spark. And Gym Spark's funded by a Vic Health Impact Research grant, and in part got up because it's really trying to address some of the populations that were disproportionately affected by the pandemic in Victoria. So they were young people. So this project is really focusing on that 18 to 35 year group, and also young people with disability. And so what we're looking to do with this project is to investigate really all the ways that we can use social support within community gym settings. So Fit Skills is one example of providing the social support that young people with disability need to be physically active, but it's not the only one. And so so one of the things that we're doing is we're identifying what types of social support have been used in the past, what types of social support are currently used at Victorian gyms, and also how we could adapt those to implement better social support in the future. So that's one really positive outcome from Fit Skills. And the other one is around cost. So if you look at the literature, it's always the same barriers. And one of the common barriers to participation in physical activity is the cost factor. But that's kind of where the data finish. It doesn't sort of tell us any more. It doesn't really explain, well, you know, what is it about cost? Is it because people truly don't have the ability to pay? Or is it more about prioritizing and that there are other priorities to do? So that's the sort of the second part of the equation. So while Fit Skills is on a, I'm hoping a hiatus at the moment, just we've been working on the Gym Spark project, and then we think Fit Skills will come online pretty soon. We're working with Down Syndrome Victoria, who've recently been awarded a an Access All Abilities program grant to actually run the Fit Skills program as one of their service offerings. So it's on pause, but it's not it hasn't stopped. The next iteration of Fit Skills is coming up.
I was just going to say like that sounds really exciting that we've still got so much to look forward to in this space. I think I'm just getting a little bit conscious of time. We've kept you for a while, so why don't we get to Azina? Is there anything else that you think is really important you want to share with our listeners about any of the work that you're doing, Nora?
Probably the other sort of thing that, you know, kind of when you sent me the questions, that it got me sort of thinking about is, you know, this work all started with this one systematic review in Down syndrome. And, you know, kind of this sort of all of these things circling back every time. But one of the things that I think is really exciting about in the field of exercise at the moment is that we're really beginning to look at and understand in a much deeper way about the effect of exercise on brain health. And I think this is the thing that really excites me about where this research could go. So, you know, when I think of people with Down syndrome, one of the biggest risks for people with Down syndrome is the risk of Alzheimer's disease. So by the time people with Down syndrome are 60 or about 60 years of age, 60% of them will have developed Alzheimer's disease. Now, in the general population, it's 1% of the general population by the time they reach 60. And I think like that's, you know, that's huge. I mean, it's a really, really big issue for this group of people. We don't have a cure for Alzheimer's disease. We don't even have very good drug therapies for Alzheimer's disease at the moment. We're really not good at treating it yet. And so, you know, when we look at, you know, even the Lancet Commission on dementia and what we need to be doing, there is this huge emphasis on prevention. And so I think the sort of quote from that advice is, you know, we have to be ambitious about prevention. And one of the things about prevention is lifestyle change, including exercise. So we know when people change their lifestyles, we can prevent, you know, I think the figure is up to 40% of dementias. Now that I think is the next frontier, and we've started to look at that. So we've got some, again, it's preliminary data, but we've got some preliminary data that suggests exercise has a benefit on cognitive function for people with Down syndrome. And so I think as a profession as a whole, that's one example, but as a profession as a whole, our next, I think, big foray is really about prevention on a much bigger scale than we're doing it at the moment. Because I think when we, you know, largely historically our work in disability has been reactive, and I think we need to be much more proactive. And I think you know, even your comment about, you know, sort of the services that you're seeing a lot more young adults with cerebral palsy coming onto the service, and part of that is because in pediatrics now we have got a really strong evidence base. We can you know, manage CP really well in childhood. But unfortunately, the wheels come off the minute those young people transition into the adult system, because it's just not set up for them. I mean, there is no medical specialty in disability. And so, you know, what ends up happening is that you have GPs managing these really complex caseloads, and that's not actually what GPs were sort of set up to do, or what maybe necessarily they have time for. So I think kind of the next frontier is very much about, you know, prevention and brain health and really thinking about systems change in the adult health service to really better facilitate the health and well-being of young people with disability.
Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying there, Nora. And I think also the allied health professions, that thought is also reflected in when, you know, people that are moving into adulthood with these sort of childhood disabilities, they enter adult services. A lot of the allied health clinicians aren't equipped with the skills to manage them either. And we've actually spoken about that before on this podcast. But the work that you're doing also with, you know, bringing it back to working with students, you know, graduating, it's really at the coalface of hopefully changing their knowledge and perspectives to take that through into the future, along with big changes like the National Disability Insurance Scheme as well, which I think has, you know, increased people's access to services and then therefore increased the demand on allied health clinicians having better skills and knowledge to deal with this. But probably a slowly changing space, I think you'd probably agree with.
Well, hopefully we can speed it up a bit, Erin.
Yeah, definitely think your work is speeding it up. Thank you so much, Nora, for your time with us today. If people do want to get in touch with you, are you happy to share your details? We can put them on our website and our podcast show notes.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Cool. Thanks so much, Nora.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
There you have it, what we hope is another thought-provoking episode of a Neurophysio podcast. If you'd like to get in touch with Nora, you can find links to her La Trobe University profile in our show notes and on Twitter at Nora Shields.
Good one. So we're always keen to hear what people think of the episode. If you liked it, please give us a rating on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. That always helps other people to find the show and interact with us on Twitter or Facebook at A Neurophysio. We can't believe that we're now coming up to nearly the end of our third year as a podcast. For us, we're continuing to enjoy exploring new topics and areas, but if you have anything else or anyone you particularly like to hear from, please let us know.
And on that note, next month's episode is another GUN researcher, but this time with a bit of a twist, with someone who's had broad research interests across neuro and other areas and is a specialist in Cochrane reviews, Professor Susan Hillier from the University of South Australia.